judges. Usually, you didn't know why a man left, unless you saw him leave and he volunteered the information. But some of them got fed up, said so loudly, and resigned, forfeiting forever their chances of franchise. Some, especially the older men, simply couldn't stand the pace physically no matter how hard they tried. I remembered one, a nice old geezer named Carruthers. Must have been 35. They carried him away in a stretcher while he was still shouting feebly that it wasn't fair, and that he would be back. It was sort of sad, because we liked Carruthers, and he did try. So we looked the other way and figured we would never see him again, that he was a cinch for medical discharge and civilian clothes. Only I did see him again, long after. He had refused discharge. You don't have to accept a medical. And wound up as third cook in a troop transport. He remembered me and wanted to talk old times, as proud of being an alumnus of Camp Curie as father is of his Harvard accent. He felt that he was a little bit better than the ordinary Navy man. Well, maybe he was. But much more important than the purpose of carving away the fat quickly and saving the government the training costs of those who would never cut it was the prime purpose of making as sure as humanly possible that no cap trooper ever climbed into a capsule for a combat drop unless he was prepared for it. Fit, resolute, disciplined, and skilled. If he was not, it's not fair to the Federation, it's certainly not fair to his teammates, and worst of all, it's not fair to him. But was boot camp more cruelly hard than was necessary? All I can say to that is, the next time I have to make a combat drop, I want the men on my flanks to be graduates of Camp Curie or its Siberian equivalent. Otherwise, I'll refuse to enter the capsule. But I certainly thought it was a bunch of crummy, vicious nonsense at the time. Little things. When we were there a week, we were issued undress maroons for parade to supplement the fatigues we had been wearing. Dress and full-dress uniforms came much later. I took my tunic back to the issue shed and complained to the supply sergeant. Since he was only a supply sergeant and rather fatherly in manner, I thought of him as a semi-civilian. I didn't know how, as of then, to read the ribbons on his chest, or I wouldn't have dared speak to him. "Sergeant, this tunic is too large. My company commander says it fits like a tent." He looked at the garment, didn't touch it. "Really?" "Yeah, I want one that fits." He still didn't stir. "Let me wise you up, sonny boy. There are just two sizes in this army, too large and too small." "But my company commander..."
"No doubt."
"But what am I going to do?" "Oh, it's advice you want." "Well, I've got that in stock. New issue, just today. Tell you what I'll do. Here's a needle, and I'll even give you a spool of thread. You won't need a pair of scissors. A razor blade is better. Now you tighten them plenty across the hips and leave cloth to loosen them again around the shoulders. You'll need it later." Sergeant Zim's only comment on my tailoring was, "You can do better than that. 2 hours extra duty." So I did better than that by next parade. Those first 6 weeks were all hardening up and hazing, with lots of parade drill and lots of route march. Eventually, as files dropped out and went home or elsewhere, we reached the point where we could do 50 miles in 10 hours on the level, which is good mileage for a good horse in case you've never used your legs. We rested, not by stopping, but by changing pace, slowing down, quick march and trot. Sometimes we went out the full distance, bivouacked and ate field rations, slept in sleeping bags, and marched back the next day. One day we started out on an ordinary day's march. No bed bags on our shoulders, no rations. When we didn't stop for lunch, I wasn't surprised, as I had already learned to sneak sugar and hard bread and such out of the mess tent and conceal it about my person. But when we kept on marching away from camp in the afternoon, I began to wonder. But I had learned not to ask silly questions. We halted shortly before dark. Three companies, now somewhat abbreviated. We formed a battalion parade and marched through it, without music. Guards were mounted, and we were dismissed. I immediately looked up Corporal Instructor Bronski, because he was a little easier to deal with than the others, and because I felt a certain amount of responsibility. I happened to be, at that time, a recruit corporal myself. These boot chevrons didn't mean much. Mostly the privilege of being chewed out for whatever your squad did, as well as for whatever you did yourself. And they could vanish as quickly as they appeared. Zim had tried out all of the older men as temporary non-coms first, and I had inherited a brassard with chevrons on it a couple of days before, when our squad leader had folded up and gone to hospital. I said, "Corporal Bronski, what's the straight word? When is chow call?" He grinned at me. "I've got a couple of crackers on me. Want me to split 'em with you?"
"Huh? Oh, no, sir, thank you."
I had considerably more than a couple of crackers. I was learning.
"No chow call?"
"They didn't tell me either, sonny, but I don't see any copters approaching. Now, if I was you, I'd round up my squad and figure things out. Maybe one of you can hit a jackrabbit with a rock."
"Yes, sir, but, well, are we staying here all night? We don't have our bedrolls."
His eyebrows shot up.
"No bedrolls? Well, I do declare."
He seemed to think it over. Ever see sheep huddling together in a snowstorm?"
"Oh, no, sir."
"Try it. They don't freeze. Maybe you won't. Or if you don't care for company, you might walk around all night. Nobody'll bother you as long as you stay inside the posted guards. You won't freeze if you keep moving. Of course, you may be a little tired tomorrow." He grinned again. I saluted and went back to my squad. We divvied up, share and share alike. And I came out with less food than I had started. Some of those idiots either hadn't sneaked out anything to eat, or had eaten all they had while we marched. But a few crackers and a couple of prunes will do a lot to quiet your stomachs sounding alert. The sheep trick works, too. Our whole section, three squads, did it together. I don't recommend it as a way to sleep. You are either in the outer layer, frozen on one side and trying to worm your way inside, or you are inside, fairly warm, but with everybody else trying to shove his elbows, feet, and halitosis on you. You migrate from one condition to the other all night long in a sort of Brownian movement, never quite waking up and never really sound asleep. All this makes a night about 100 years long. We turned out at dawn to the familiar shout of, "Up you come on the bounce," encouraged by instructors' batons applied smartly on fundaments sticking out of the piles, and then we did setting up exercises. I felt like a corpse and didn't see how I could touch my toes, but I did, though it hurt, and 20 minutes later when we hit the trail I merely felt elderly. Sergeant Zim wasn't even mussed, and somehow the scoundrel had managed to shave. The sun warmed our backs as we marched, and Zim started us singing. Oldies at first, like Le Regiment des Sombres et Muses, and Caissons, and Halls of Montezuma, and then our own Cap Trooper's Polka, which moves you into quick step and pulls you on into a trot. Sergeant Zim couldn't carry a tune in a sack. All he had was a loud voice. But Breckenridge had a sure, strong lead, and could hold the rest of us in the teeth of Zim's terrible false notes. We all felt cocky and covered with spines. But we didn't feel cocky 50 miles later. It had been a long night. It was an endless day, and Zim chewed us out for the way we looked on parade,
and several boots got gigged for failing to shave. In the 9 whole minutes between the time we fell out after the march and fell back in for parade. Several recruits resigned that evening, and I thought about it, but didn't, because I had those silly boot chevrons, and hadn't been busted yet. That night there was a 2-hour alert. But eventually I learned to appreciate the homey luxury of 2 or 3 dozen warm bodies to snuggle up to, because 12 weeks later they dumped me down raw naked in a primitive area of the Canadian Rockies, and I had to make my way 40 miles through mountains. I made it, and hated the army every inch of the way. I wasn't in too bad shape when I checked in, though. A couple of rabbits had failed to stay alert as I was, so I didn't go entirely hungry, nor entirely naked. I had a nice, warm, thick coat of rabbit fat and dirt on my body and moccasins on my feet, the rabbits having no further use for their skins. It's amazing what you can do with a flake of rock if you have to. I guess our caveman ancestors weren't such dummies as we usually think. The others made it too, those who were still around to try and didn't resign rather than take the test. All except 2 boys, who died trying. Then we all went back into the mountains and spent 13 days finding them, working with copters overhead to direct us, and all the best communication gear to help us, and our instructors in powered command suits to supervise and to check rumors, because the mobile infantry doesn't abandon its own while there is any thin shred of hope. Then we buried them with full honors to the strains of "This Land Is Ours," and with the posthumous rank of PFC, the first of our boot regiment to go that high, because a cap trooper isn't necessarily expected to stay alive. Dying is part of his trade. But they care a lot about how you die. It has to be heads up, on the bounce, and still trying. Breckenridge was one of them. The other was an Aussie boy I didn't know. They weren't the first to die in training. They weren't the last. 5. "He's bound to be guilty or he wouldn't be here. Starboard gun fire. Shooting's too good for him. Kick the louse out. Port gun fire." Ancient shanty used to time saluting guns. But that was after we had left Camp Curie, and a lot had happened in between. Combat training, mostly. Combat drill and combat exercises and combat maneuvers, using everything from bare hands to simulated nuclear weapons. I hadn't known there were so many different ways to fight. Hands and feet to start with. And if you think those aren't weapons, you haven't seen Sergeant Zim and Captain Frankel, our battalion commander, demonstrate La Civette, or had little Sujumo work you over with just his hands and a toothy grin. Zim made Sujumo our instructor for that purpose at once and required us to take his orders, although we didn't have to salute him or say sir. As our ranks thinned down, Zim quit bothering with formations himself, except parade, and spent more and more time in personal instruction, supplementing the corporal instructors. He was sudden death with anything, but he loved knives, and made and balanced his own, instead of using the perfectly good general-issue ones. He mellowed quite a bit as a personal teacher, too, becoming merely unbearable instead of downright disgusting. He could be quite patient with silly questions. Once, during one of the 2-minute rest periods that were scattered sparsely through each day's work, one of the boys, a kid named Ted Hendrick, asked, "Sergeant, I guess this knife throwing is fun, but why do we have to learn it? What possible use is it?" "Well," answered Zim, "suppose all you have is a knife, or maybe not even a knife. What do you do? Just say your prayers and die? Or wade in and make him buy it anyhow? Son, this is real. It's not a checker game you can concede if you find yourself too far behind. But it's just what I mean, sir. Suppose you aren't armed at all, or just one of these toad stickers, say. And the man you're up against has all sorts of dangerous weapons. There's nothing you can do about it. He's got you licked on showdown. Zim said almost gently, "You've got it all wrong, son. There's no such thing as a dangerous weapon." "Huh? Sir?" "There are no dangerous weapons. There are only dangerous men. We're trying to teach you to be dangerous, to the enemy. Dangerous even without a knife. Deadly as long as you still have one hand or one foot and are still alive. If you don't know what I mean, go read Horatius at the Bridge, or The Death of Bonhomme Richard. They're both in the camp library. But take the case you first mentioned. I'm you, and all you have is a knife. That target behind me, the one you've been missing, number 3, is a sentry armed with everything but an H-bomb. You've got to get him, quietly, at once, and without letting him call for help." Zim turned slightly. Thunk. A knife he hadn't even had in his hand was quivering in the center of target number 3. "You see? Best to carry 2 knives. But get him you must, even barehanded." Something still troubling you? Speak up." "That's what I'm here for, to answer your questions."
Yes, sir. You said the sentry didn't have any H-bomb.
But he does have an H-bomb. That's just the point.
Well, at least we have, if we're the sentry. And any sentry we're up against is likely to have them too. I don't mean the sentry, I mean the side he's on."
"I understand you."
"Well, you see, sir, if we can use an H-bomb, and, as you said, it's no checker game, it's real, it's war, and nobody's fooling around, isn't it sort of ridiculous to go crawling around in the weeds, throwing knives and maybe getting yourself killed, and even losing the war, when you've got a real weapon you can use to win? What's the point in a whole lot of men risking their lives with obsolete weapons when one professor type can do much more just by pushing a button?"
Zim didn't answer at once, which wasn't like him at all. Then he said softly, "Are you happy in the infantry, Hendrik? You can resign, you know."
Hendrik muttered something. Zim said, "Speak up."
"I'm not itching to resign, sir. I'm going to sweat out my term."
"I see. Well, the question you asked is one that a sergeant isn't really qualified to answer, and one that you shouldn't ask me. You're supposed to know the answer before you join up, or you should. Did your school have a course in history and moral philosophy?"
"What? Sure. Yes, sir."
"Then you've heard the answer, but I'll give you my own unofficial views on it. If you wanted to teach a baby a lesson, would you cut its head off?"
"Why, no, sir."
"Of course not. You'd paddle it. There can be circumstances when it's just as foolish to hit an enemy city with an H-bomb as it would be to spank a baby with an axe. War is not violence and killing, pure and simple. War is controlled violence for a purpose. The purpose of war is to support your government's decisions by force. The purpose is never to kill the enemy just to be killing him, but to make him do what you want him to do. Not killing, but controlled and purposeful violence. But it's not your business or mine to decide the purpose of the control. It's never a soldier's business to decide when or where or how or why he fights. That belongs to the statesmen and the generals. The statesmen decide why and how much. The generals take it from there and tell us where and when and how. We supply the violence. Other people, older and wiser heads, as they say, supply the control, which is as it should be. That's the best answer I can give you. If it doesn't satisfy you, I'll get you a chit to go talk to the regimental commander. If he can't convince you, then go home and be a civilian. Because in that case, you will certainly never make a soldier." Zim bounced to his feet.
"I think you've kept me talking just a gold brick. Up you come, soldiers, on the bounce. Man stations, on target. Hendrik, you first. This time I want you to throw that knife south of you. South, get it? Not north. The target is due south of you, and I want that knife to go in a general southerly direction. At least. I know you won't hit the target, but see if you can scare it a little. Don't slice your ear off. Don't let go of it and cut somebody behind you. Just keep what tiny mind you have fixed on the idea of south. Ready? On target. Let fly.
Hendrik missed it again. We trained with sticks, and we trained with wire. Lots of nasty things you can improvise with a piece of wire. And we learned what can be done with really modern weapons, and how to do it, and how to service and maintain the equipment. Simulated nuclear weapons and infantry rockets and various sorts of gas and poison and incendiary and demolition. As well as other things maybe best not discussed. But we learned a lot of obsolete weapons, too. Bayonets on dummy guns, for example. And guns that weren't dummies, too, but were almost identical to the infantry rifle of the 20th century. Much like the sporting rifles used in hunting game, except that we fired nothing but solid slugs, alloy-jacketed lead bullets, both at targets on measured ranges and at surprise targets on booby-trapped skirmish runs. This was supposed to prepare us to learn to use any armed weapon and to train us to be on the bounce, alert, ready for anything. Well, I suppose it did. I'm pretty sure it did. We used these rifles in field exercises to simulate a lot of deadlier and nastier aimed weapons, too. We used a lot of simulation. We had to. An explosive bomb or grenade, against materiel or personnel, would explode just enough to put out a lot of black smoke. Another sort of gave off a gas that would make you sneeze and weep. That told you that you were dead or paralyzed. And was nasty enough to make you careful about anti-gas precautions, to say nothing of the chewing out you got if you were caught by it. We got less sleep. More than half the exercises were held at night, with snoopers and radar and audio gear and such. The rifles used to simulate aimed weapons were loaded with blanks, except one in 500 rounds at random, which was a real bullet. Dangerous? Yes and no. It's dangerous just to be alive. And a non-explosive bullet probably won't kill you unless it hits you in the head or the heart, and maybe not then. What that 1 in 500 for real did was to give us a deep interest in taking cover, especially as we knew that some of the rifles were being fired by instructors who were crack shots, and actually trying their best to hit you, if the round happened not to be blank. They assured us that they would not intentionally shoot a man in the head, but accidents do happen. This friendly assurance wasn't very reassuring. That 500th bullet turned tedious exercises into large-scale Russian roulette. You stop being bored the very first time you hear a slug go wheat past your ear before you hear the crack of the rifle. But we did slack down anyhow. The word came down from the top that if we didn't get on the bounce, the incidence of real ones would be changed to 1 in 100, and if that didn't work, to 1 in 50. I don't know whether a change was made or not. No way to tell. But I do know we tightened up again, because a boy in the next company got creased across his buttocks with a live one, producing an amazing scar and a lot of half-witty comments, and a renewed interest by all hands in taking cover. We laughed at this kid for getting shot where he did, but we all knew it could have been his head, or our own heads. The instructors who were not firing rifles did not take cover. They put on white shirts and walked around upright with their silly canes, apparently calmly certain that even a recruit would not intentionally shoot an instructor, which may have been overconfidence on the part of some of them. Still, the chances were 500 to 1 that even a shot aimed with murderous intent would not be live, and the safety factor increased still higher because the recruit probably couldn't shoot that well anyhow.
A rifle is not an easy weapon. It's got no target-seeking qualities at all. I understand that even back in the days when wars were fought and decided with such rifles, it used to take several thousand fired shots to average killing one man. It seems impossible. But the military histories agree that it must be true. Apparently most shots weren't really aimed, but simply acted to force the enemy to keep his head down and interfere with his shooting. In any case, we had no instructors wounded or killed by rifle fire. No trainees were killed either by rifle bullets. The deaths were all from other weapons or things, some of which could turn around and bite you if you didn't do things by the book. Well, one boy did manage to break his neck taking cover too enthusiastically when we first started shooting at him, but no bullet touched him. However, by a chain reaction, this matter of rifle bullets and taking cover brought me to my lowest ebb at Camp Curie. In the first place, I had been busted out of my boot chevrons. Not over what I did, but over something one of my squad did when I wasn't even around. Which I pointed out. Bronski told me to button my lip, so I went to see Zim about it. He told me coldly that I was responsible for what my men did, regardless, and tacked on 6 hours of extra duty besides busting me for having spoken to him about it without Bronski's permission. Then I got a letter that upset me a lot. My mother finally wrote to me. Then I sprained my shoulder on my first drill with powered armor. They've got those practice suits rigged so that the instructor can cause casualties in the suit at will, by radio control. I got dumped and hurt my shoulder. And this put me on light duty with too much time to think. At a time when I had many reasons, it seemed to me, to feel sorry for myself. Because of light duty, I was ordered that day in the battalion commander's office. I was eager at first, for I had never been there before and wanted to make a good impression. I discovered that Captain Frankel didn't want zeal. He wanted me to sit still, say nothing, and not bother him. This left me time to sympathize with myself, for I didn't dare go to sleep. Then suddenly, shortly after lunch, I wasn't a bit sleepy. Sergeant Zim came in, followed by 3 men. Zim was smart and neat as usual, but the expression on his face made him look like death on a pale horse, and he had a mark on his right eye that looked as if it might be shaping up into a shiner, which was impossible, of course. Of the other 3, the one in the middle was Ted Hendrick. He was dirty. Well, the company had been on a field exercise. They don't scrub those prairies, and you spent a lot of your time snuggling up in the dirt. But his lip was split, and there was blood on his chin, and on his shirt, and his cap was missing. He looked wild-eyed. The men on each side of him were boots. They each had rifles. Hendrick did not. One of them was from my squad, a kid named Levy. He seemed excited and pleased, and slipped me a wink when nobody was looking. Captain Frankel looked surprised. "What is this, Sergeant?" Zim stood frozen straight and spoke as if he were reciting something by rote. "Sir, H Company Commander reports to the Battalion Commander. Discipline, Article 9107. Disregard of tactical command and doctrine. The team being in simulated combat. Article 9120. Disobedience of orders, same conditions." Captain Frankel looked puzzled. "You are bringing this to me, Sergeant? Officially?" I don't see how a man can manage to look as embarrassed as Zim looked and still have no expression of any sort in his voice or face. "Sir, if the captain pleases, the man refused administrative discipline. He insisted on seeing the battalion commander." "I see. A bedroll lawyer. Well, I still don't understand it, Sergeant, but technically that's his privilege. What was the tactical command and doctrine?" "A freeze, sir." I glanced at Hendrick, thinking, he's going to catch it. "In a freeze, you hit the dirt.
taking any cover you can, fast, and then freeze. Don't move at all. Not even twitch an eyebrow until released. Or you can freeze when you're already in cover. They tell stories about men who had been hit while in freeze and had died slowly, but without ever making a sound or a move. Frankel's brows shot up.
Second part?
Same thing, sir. After breaking freeze, failing to return to it on being so ordered. Captain Frankel looked grim.
Name?
Zim answered. Hendrick, T.C., sir. Recruit Private RP7960924.
Very well.
Hendrick, you are deprived of all privileges for 30 days and restricted to your tent when not on duty or at meals, subject only to sanitary necessities. You will serve 3 hours extra duty each day under the corporal of the guard, 1 hour to be served just before taps, 1 hour just before reveille, 1 hour at the time of the noonday meal and in place of it. Your evening meal will be bread and water, as much bread as you can eat. You will serve 10 extra hours duty each Sunday, the time to be adjusted to permit you to attend divine services if you so elect.
I thought, oh my, he threw the book.
Captain Frankel went on. Hendrick, the only reason you are getting off so lightly is that I am not permitted to give you any more than that without convening a court-martial, and I don't want to spoil your company's record. Dismissed. He dropped his eyes back to the papers on his desk, the incident already forgotten. And Hendrick yelled. You don't want to hear my side of it? The captain looked up.
Oh, sorry, you have a side?
You're darn right I do. Sergeant Zim's got it in for me. He's been riding me all day long from the time I got here.
That's his job, the captain said coldly.
Do you deny the 2 charges against you?
No, but
he didn't tell you I was lying on an anthill.
Frankel looked disgusted.
Oh, so you would get yourself killed and perhaps your teammates as well because of a few little ants?
Not just a few. There were hundreds of them. Stingers.
So? Young man, let me put you straight. Had it been a nest of rattlesnakes, you would still have been expected and required to freeze.
Frankel paused.
Have you anything at all to say in your defense?
Hendrick's mouth was open.
I certainly do. I hit him. He laid hands on me. The whole bunch of them are always strutting around with those silly batons, whacking you across the fanny, punching you between the shoulders and telling you to brace up. And I put up with it. But he hit me with his hands. He knocked me down to the ground and yelled, "Freeze, you stupid jackass!" How about that?
Captain Frankel looked down at his hands, looked up again at Hendrick.
Young man, you are under a misapprehension very common among civilians. You think that your superior officers are not permitted to lay hands on you, as you put it. Under purely social conditions, that is true. Say if we happened to run across each other in a theater or a shop, I would have no more right, as long as you treated me with respect, due my rank, to slap your face, then you would have to slap mine. But in line of duty, the rule is entirely different.
The captain swung around in his chair and pointed at some loose-leaf books.
There are the laws under which you live. You can search every article in those books, every court-martial case which has arisen under them, and you will not find one word which says or implies that your superior officer may not lay hands on you or strike you in any other manner in the line of duty. Hendrick, I could break your jaw, and I simply would be responsible to my own superior officers as to the appropriate necessity of the act. But I would not be responsible to you. I could do more than that. There are circumstances under which a superior officer, commissioned or not, is not only permitted but required to kill an officer or a man under him without delay and perhaps without warning, and,
far from being punished, be commended. To put a stop to pusillanimous conduct in the face of the enemy, for example. The captain tapped his desk. Now about these batons. They have two uses. First, they mark the man in authority. Second, we expect them to be used on you, to touch you up and keep you on the bounce. You can't possibly be hurt with one, not the way they are used. At the most, they sting a little. But they save thousands of words. Say you don't turn out on the bounce at Reveille. No doubt the duty corporal could wheedle you, say pretty please with sugar on it, inquire if you'd like breakfast in bed this morning. If we could spare one career corporal, just a nursemaid you. We can't. So he gives your bedroll a whack and trots on down the line, applying the spur where needed. Of course, he could simply kick you, which would be just as legal and nearly as effective. But the general in charge of training and discipline thinks that is more dignified, both for the duty corporal and for you, to snap a late sleeper out of his fog with the impersonal rod of authority. And so do I. Not that it matters what you or I think about it. This is the way we do it. Captain Frankel sighed. Hendrik, I have explained these matters to you because it is useless to punish a man unless he knows why he's being punished. You've been a bad boy. I say boy because you quite evidently aren't a man yet. Although we'll keep trying. A surprisingly bad boy in view of the stage of your training. Nothing you have said is any defense, nor even any mitigation. You don't seem to know the score, nor have any idea of your duty as a soldier. So tell me in your own words why you feel mistreated. I want to get you straightened out. There might even be something in your favor, though I confess that I cannot imagine what it could be. I had sneaked a look or two at Hendrik's face while the captain was chewing him out. Somehow his quiet, mild words were a worse chewing out than any Zim had ever given us. Hendrik's expression had gone from indignation to blank astonishment to sullenness. "Speak up," Frankel added sharply. "Well, we were ordered to freeze, and I hit the dirt, and I found I was on this anthill. So I got to my knees to move over a couple of feet, and I was hit from behind and knocked flat, and he yelled at me. And I bounced up, and I popped him one, and he..." "Stop." Captain Frankel was out of his chair and standing 10 feet tall, though he's hardly taller than I am. He stared at Hendrik. "You struck your company commander?" "Huh? I said so, but he hit me first, from behind. I didn't even see him. I don't take that off of anybody. I popped him, and then he hit me again, and then..." "Silence." Hendrik stopped. Then he added, "I just want out of this lousy outfit." "I think we can accommodate you," Frankel said icily. "And quickly, too." "Just give me a piece of paper. I'm resigning." "One moment. Sergeant Zim?" "Yes, sir." Zim hadn't said a word for a long time. He just stood, eyes front and rigid as a statue, nothing moving but his twitching jaw muscles. I looked at him now and saw that it certainly was a shiner, a beaut. Hendrik must have caught him just right. But he hadn't said anything about it, and Captain Frankel hadn't asked. Maybe he had just assumed Zim had run into a door and would explain it if he felt like it, later. "Have the pertinent articles been published to your company as required?"
"Yes, sir, published and logged every Sunday morning."
"I know they have. I asked simply for the record." Just before church call every Sunday, they lined us up and read aloud the disciplinary articles out of the laws and regulations of the military forces. They were posted on the bulletin board, too, outside the orderly tent. Nobody paid them much mind. It was just another drill. You could stand still and sleep through it. About the only thing we noticed, if we noticed anything, was what we called the 31 ways to crash land. After all, the instructors see to it that you soak up all the regulations you need to know through your skin. The crash landings were a worn-out joke, like reveille oil and tent jacks. They were the 31 capital offenses. Now and then somebody boasted, or accused somebody else, of having found a 32nd way. Always something preposterous, and usually obscene. Striking a superior officer. It suddenly wasn't amusing any longer. Popping Zim? Hang a man for that? Why, almost everybody in the company had taken a swing at Sergeant Zim, and some of us had even landed when he was instructing us in hand-to-hand combat. He would take us on after the other instructors had worked us over, and we were beginning to feel cocky and pretty good at it. Then he would put the polish on. Why, shucks, I once saw Shijumi knock him unconscious. Bronski threw water on him, and Zim got up and grinned and shook hands, and threw Shijumi right over the horizon. Captain Franco looked around, motioned at me. You. Flash Regimental Headquarters. I did it, all thumbs. Stepped back when an officer's face came on and let the captain take the call. Adjutant, the face said. Frankel said crisply, Second Battalion Commander's respects to the regimental commander. I request and require an officer to sit as a court. The face said, When do you need him, Ian? As quickly as you can get him here.
Right away. I'm pretty sure Jake is in his HQ. Article and name?
Captain Frankel identified Hendrick and quoted an article number. The face in the screen whistled and looked grim.
On the bounce, Ian. If I can't get Jake, I'll be over myself. Just as soon as I tell the old man.
Captain Frankel turned to Zim. This escort, are they witnesses?
Yes, sir.
Did his section leader see it?
Zim barely hesitated.
I think so, sir.
Get him.
Anybody out that way in a powered suit?
Yes, sir.
Zim used the phone while Frankel said to Hendrick, What witnesses do you wish to call in your defense?
Huh? I don't need any witnesses. He knows what he did. Just hand me a piece of paper. I'm getting out of here.
All in good time. In very fast time, it seemed to me. Less than 5 minutes later, Corporal Jones came bouncing up in a command suit, carrying Corporal Mahmoud in his arms. He dropped Mahmoud and bounced away just as Lieutenant Speaksma came in. He said,
Afternoon, Captain.
Accused and witnesses here?
All set. Take it, Jake.
Recorder on?
It is now.
Very well. Hendrick, step forward.
Hendrick did so, looking puzzled and as if his nerve was beginning to crack.
Lieutenant Speaksmo said briskly, Field court-martial, convened by order of Major F.X. Malloy, commanding 3rd Training Regiment, Camp Arthur Currie, under General Order No. 4, issued by Commanding General Training and Discipline Command. Pursuant to the laws and regulations of the military forces, Terran Federation, Remanding Officer, Captain Ian Frankel, M.I., assigned to the commanding 2nd Battalion, 3rd Regiment. The court, Lieutenant Jacques Speaksma, M.I., assigned to and commanding 1st Battalion, 3rd Regiment. Accused, Hendrick Theodore C., Recruit Private RP7960924, Article 9080. Charge, striking his superior officer, the Terran Federation, then being in a state of emergency. The thing that got me was how fast it went. I found myself suddenly appointed as an officer of the court and directed to remove the witnesses and have them ready. I didn't know how I would remove Sergeant Zim if he didn't feel like it. But he gathered Mahmoud and the two boots up by eye and they all went outside, out of earshot. Zim separated himself from the others and simply waited. Mahmoud sat down on the ground and rolled a cigarette, which he had to put out. He was the first one called.
In less than 20 minutes, all three of them had testified, all telling much the same story Hendrik had. Zim wasn't called at all. Lieutenant Speaksma said to Hendrik, "Do you wish to cross-examine the witnesses? The court will assist you, if you wish."
"No."
"Stand at attention and say sir when you address the court."
"No, sir," he added.
"I want a lawyer." "The law does not permit counsel in field court-martials. Do you wish to testify in your own defense? You are not required to do so, and, in view of the evidence thus far, the court will take no judicial notice if you choose not to do so. But you are warned that any testimony that you give may be used against you, and that you will be subject to cross-examination."
Hendrik shrugged.
"I haven't anything to say. What good would it do me?" "The court repeats, will you testify in your own defense?"
No, sir."
"The court must demand of you one technical question. Was the article under which you are charged published to you before the time of the alleged offense of which you stand accused?" "You may answer yes or no or stand mute. But you are responsible for your answer under Article 9167, which relates to perjury." The accused stood mute. "Very well, the court will reread the article of the charge allowed to you and again ask you that question. Article 9080. Any person in the military forces who strikes or assaults, or attempts to strike or assault..." "Oh, I suppose they did. They read a lot of stuff, every Sunday morning. A whole long list of things you couldn't do." "Was or was not that particular article read to you?"
Yes, sir, it was."
"Very well. Having declined to testify, do you have any statement to make in mitigation or extenuation?"
"Sir?"
"Do you want to tell the court anything about it? Any circumstances which you think might possibly affect the evidence already given? Or anything which might lessen the alleged offense?"
"Such things as being ill or under drugs or medication?"
"You are not under oath at this point. You may say anything at all which you think may help you. What the court is trying to find out is this. Does anything about this matter strike you as being unfair? If so, why?"
"Huh?
Of course it is. Everything about it is unfair. He hit me first. You heard him. He hit me first."
"Anything more?"
"Huh?"
"No, sir."
"Isn't that enough?" "The trial is completed. Recruit Private Theodore C. Hendrik, stand forth." Lieutenant Speaksma had been standing at attention the whole time. Now Captain Frankel stood up. The place suddenly felt chilly. "Private Hendrik, you are found guilty as charged." My stomach did a flip-flop. They were going to do it to him. They were going to do the Danny Deaver to Ted Hendrik. And I had eaten breakfast beside him just this morning. "The court sentences you," he went on, while I felt sick, 10 lashes and bad conduct discharge." Hendrik gulped. "I want to resign." "The court does not permit you to resign. The court wishes to add that your punishment is light, simply because this court possesses no jurisdiction to assign greater punishment. The authority which remanded you specified a field court-martial. Why it so chose, this court will not speculate. But had you been remanded for general court-martial, it seems certain that the evidence before this court would have caused a general court to sentence you to hang by the neck until dead. You are very lucky. And the remanding authority has been most merciful." Lieutenant Speaksma paused, then went on. "The sentence will be carried out at the earliest hour after the convening authority has reviewed and approved the record, if it does so approve. The court is adjourned. Remove and confine him." The last was addressed to me, but I didn't actually have to do anything about it, other than phone the guard tent and then get a receipt for him when they took him away.
At afternoon sick call, Captain Frankel took me off orderly and sent me to see the doctor, who sent me back to duty. I got back to my company just in time to dress and fall in for parade, and to get gigged by Zim for spots on my uniform. Well, he had a bigger spot over one eye, but I didn't mention it. Somebody had set up a big post in the parade ground just back of where the adjutant stood. When it came time to publish the orders, instead of routine order of the day or other trivia, they published Hendrick's court-martial. Then they marched him out between two armed guards with his hands cuffed together in front of him. I had never seen a flogging. Back home, while they do it in public, of course, they do it back of the federal building, and Father had given me strict orders to stay away from there. I tried disobeying him on it once, but it was postponed and I never tried to see it again. Once is too many. The guards lifted his arms and hooked the manacles over a big hook high on the post. Then they took his shirt off, and it turned out that it was fixed so that it could come off, and he didn't have an undershirt. The adjutant said crisply, "Carry out the sentence of the court." A corporal instructor from some other battalion stepped forward with a whip. The sergeant of the guard made the count. It's a slow count, 5 seconds between each one, and it seems much longer. Ted didn't let out a peep until the third. Then he sobbed. The next thing I knew, I was staring up at Corporal Bronski. He was slapping me and looking intently at me. He stopped and asked, "Okay now? All right, back in ranks, on the bounce. We're about to pass in review." We did so and marched back to our company areas. I didn't eat much dinner, but neither did a lot of them. Nobody said a word to me about fainting. I found out later that I wasn't the only one. A couple of dozen of us had passed out. 6. What we obtain too cheap, we esteem too lightly. It would be strange indeed if so celestial an article as freedom should not be highly rated. Thomas Paine. It was the night after Hendrick was kicked out that I reached my lowest slump at Camp Curie. I couldn't sleep, and you have to have been through boot camp to understand just how far down a recruit has to sink before that can happen. But I hadn't had any real exercise all day, so I wasn't physically tired, and my shoulder still hurt even though I had been marked duty, and I had that letter from my mother preying on my mind, and every time I closed my eyes I would hear that crack and see Ted slump against the whipping post. I wasn't fretting about losing my boot chevrons. That no longer mattered at all, because I was ready to resign, determined to. If it hadn't been the middle of the night and no pen and paper handy, I would have done so right then. Ted had made a bad mistake, one that lasted all of half a second. And it really had been just a mistake, too, because while he hated the outfit, who liked it, he had been trying to sweat it out and win his franchise. He meant to go into politics. He talked a lot about how, when he got his citizenship, "There will be some changes made. You wait and see." Well, he would never be in public office now. He had taken his finger off his number for a single instant, and he was through. If it could happen to him, it could happen to me. Suppose I slipped. Next day or next week, not even allowed to resign, but drummed out with my back striped. Time to admit that I was wrong and Father was right. Time to put in that little piece of paper and slink home, and tell Father that I was ready to go to Harvard, and then go to work in the business, if he would still let me. Time to see Sergeant Zim, first thing in the morning, and tell him I had had it. But not until morning, because you don't wake Sergeant Zim except for something you're certain that he will class as an emergency. Believe me, you don't. Not Sergeant Zim. Sergeant Zim. He worried me as much as Ted's case did.
After the court-martial was over and Ted had been taken away, he stayed behind and said to Captain Frankel, "May I speak with the battalion commander, sir?" "Certainly. I was intending to ask you to stay behind for a word. Sit down."
Zim flicked his eyes my way, and the captain looked at me, and I didn't have to be told to get out. I faded. There was nobody in the outer office, just a couple of civilian clerks. I didn't dare go outside because the captain might want me. I found a chair back of a row of files and sat down. I could hear them talking through the partition I had my head against. BHQ was a building, rather than a tent, since it housed permanent communication and recording equipment. But it was a minimum field building. A shack. The inner partitions weren't much. I doubt if the civilians could hear, as they each were wearing transcriber phones and were bent over typers. Besides, they didn't matter. I didn't mean to eavesdrop. Well, maybe I did. Zim said, "Sir, I request a transfer to a combat team." Frankel answered, "I can't hear you, Charlie. My tin ear is bothering me again." Zim, "I'm quite serious, sir. This isn't my sort of duty." Frankel said testedly, "Quit bellyaching about your troubles to me, Sergeant. At least wait until we've disposed of duty matters. What in the world happened?" Zim said stiffly, "Captain, that boy doesn't rate 10 lashes. Frankel answered, "Of course he doesn't. You know who goofed, and so do I." "Yes, sir, I know." "Well?" "You know even better than I do that these kids are wild animals at this stage. You know when it's safe to turn your back on them and when it isn't. You know the doctrine and the standing orders about Article 9080. You must never give them a chance to violate it. Of course, some of them are going to try it. If they weren't aggressive, they wouldn't be material for the MI. They're docile in ranks. It's safe enough to turn your back when they're eating or sleeping or sitting on their tails or being lectured. But get them out in the field in a combat exercise, or anything that gets them keyed up and full of adrenaline, they're as explosive as a hat full of mercury fulminate. You know that. All you instructors know that. You're trained. Trained to watch for it. Trained to snuff it out before it happens. Explain to me how it was possible for an untrained recruit to hang a mouse on your eye. He should have never laid a hand on you. You should have knocked him cold when you saw what he was up to. So why weren't you on the bounce? Are you slowing down?" "I don't know," Zim answered slowly. "I guess I must be." "If true, a combat team is the last place for you. But it's not true, or wasn't true the last time you and I worked out together 3 days ago. So what slipped?" Zim was slow in answering. "I think I had him tagged in my mind as one of the safe ones."
"There are no such."
"Yes, sir, but he was so earnest, so doggedly determined to sweat it out. He didn't have any aptitude, but he kept on trying. That I must have done that subconsciously." Zim was silent, then added, "I guess it was because I liked him." Frankel snorted. "An instructor can afford to like a man." "I know it, sir, but I do. They're a nice bunch of kids. We've dumped all the real twerps by now. Hendrick's only shortcoming, aside from being clumsy, was that he thought he knew all the answers. I didn't mind that. I knew it all at that age myself. The twerps have gone home, and those that are left are eager, anxious to please, and on the bounce. As cute as a litter of collie pups. A lot of them will make soldiers." "So that was the soft spot. You liked him. So you failed to clip him in time. So he winds up with a court and a whip and a BCD. Sweet." Zim said earnestly, "I wish to heaven
There was some way for me to take that flogging myself, sir.
You'd have to take your turn. I outrank you. What do you think I've been wishing the past hour? What do you think I was afraid of from the moment I saw you?